Welcome to the Asia Chessboard, the podcast that examines geopolitical dynamics in Asia and takes an inside look at the making of grand strategy. I'm Andrew Schwartz at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
This week, Mike and Jude are joined by Richard Bush, non-resident senior fellow in the Center for Asia Policy Studies and the John L. Thornton China Center at the Brookings Institution. They discuss Taiwan's recent elections in January 2024.
Welcome back to the Asia Chessboard. I'm Mike Green. I'm joined by my colleague from CSIS, Jude Blanchett, and with a good friend to both of us and a real font of wisdom on East Asia and Washington, Richard Bush. Welcome, Richard. We're delighted you were able to join us.
Well, I'm happy to be with you. Thanks for inviting me.
So, Richard, you held senior positions at the Brookings Institution. You worked on the Hill at a critical moment in the 80s and 90s. You were director of AIT and had a role in managing the U.S. interactions with Taiwan. That's a pretty full plate. How did you actually get started on this journey?
The story starts when I was 12 years old. My parents were missionaries, and we decided on my father's whim to go to Burma. This was in 1960. The Burmese wouldn't let us in, so Hong Kong was Plan B. So I spent five of my secondary school years in Hong Kong. The experience of living in a Chinese society for that period of time ultimately led to my decision to do China. Now, I must say I didn't learn anything about China at the British middle school that I went to, but it's just living there and seeing Hong Kong close up. I'm one of the last missionary kids in the China field. Then when I started college, I thought I wanted to do European history, but quickly switched to China. My career goal was to be a university professor somewhere. I had the opportunity in 1983 to join the staff of the House Foreign Affairs Committee in the U.S. Congress. I worked for a congressman named Steve Solars. He was chairman of the Asian Affairs Subcommittee. He had me working on China and Taiwan and Indochina and Latin America, but he set as one of his goals promoting democracy and human rights in Taiwan. He's a small D Democrat, and he thought Taiwan was ready for democracy. And by the time he left the Congress in 1992, Taiwan was basically there. It had held elections for the legislature, popular elections. I then served for a little while in the intelligence community, was for 5 years the chairman of the American Institute in Taiwan, which is the mechanism through which the U.S. government conducts substantive relations with Taiwan. And then in 2002, when I was 55 years old, Brookings came to me and said, how would you like to come work for us? And it was the Bush administration, and I had heard that there was a wealthy Republican woman who was after my job, somebody that Mike knows too well. So I jumped at the chance. I was fortunate to be able to spend 18 years writing books and other things about the policy issues that I'd worked on in government.
So I remember Steve Solars when I was in graduate school. In retrospect, and I will now make my confession, you can say I was wrong. I probably should have emphasized Solars more in the history I wrote of U.S. engagement with Asia, because looking in certainly the Cold War and post-Cold War period, maybe even the whole sweep of American history, and there was a House Foreign Affairs Committee, and there were hearings on Asia back in the 1840s and 50s. But Solars from New York may have been the most activist chair of that subcommittee ever. What do you think? Is that, should I have emphasized him more in the book I wrote?
Sure. I think you should have. He was one of the smartest people I've ever come in contact with. He was a relentless and precise questioner. I felt sometimes in a hearing room that this was more like a rabbi conducting a session with his parishioners or whatever you call them, and because he could work logically through a problem. Often we would come out in a different or better place at the end of the hearing than at the beginning. He also played a significant role in the removal of Ferdinand Marcos from being president of the Philippines. He played, along with Gareth Evans of Australia, a significant role in supporting the peace process concerning Cambodia that led to an act of self-determination by the Cambodian people. It was really an honor to work for somebody like that and to feel, first of all, that you were working for somebody who really cared about policy, really understood policy, but also understood how to use the tools of influence to make an impact.
That was a really critical time, actually, when you started working for Solars on the Hill. It's the 1980s. The Reagan administration came in, focused on countering Soviet expansion and communism. There were huge debates. Meanwhile, you had this pressure from within for more democratization in Korea and Philippines and in Taiwan. We managed to get through it pretty well. It's a good segue to what we want to focus on in this discussion, which is Taiwan's election. The U.S. stands by Taiwan. There's the Taiwan Relations Act commitments and so forth. But some people watch elections in Taiwan with a bit of nervousness. How did you think that the election of Lai Ching-te and the outcome in January affected U.S. interests? How do you think the administration saw it? How do you think the administration handled it?
Those are good questions. At the outset, it is worth noting that this election was another milestone in Taiwan's democratic development. The first competitive election was back in 1996. This contest was free and fair. All policy approaches were fully aired. The process of voting and counting was clean and uncontested, which is different from some other places around the world that I know. So it was a good reflection of the popular will. I think the Biden administration did a really good job in handling this election. It took a neutral position on who should be elected, either formally or informally. And in the U.S. view, it was and is up to the Taiwan voters to decide their leader. So there was a deliberate effort, for example, to treat each of the candidates equally and make sure that none of them could complain that the U.S. was favoring one of their competitors. Because this was going to be a complicated election with three people running at least, and because the outcome was unpredictable, our diplomats understood that they needed to up their game. They needed to engage intensively with the various candidates, with their principal aides, with their staffs, A, to make sure we understood what their policy views were, B, to make sure they understood what U.S. policy was concerning Taiwan, C, to establish habits of communication with each of them so that when one of them emerged as president, we would already have the communications channels that we needed. I think that a lot of this was done very quietly. Nobody knows it was happening, but it was. It was through a lot of effort that we are about as well positioned as we can be for whatever comes next.
You know, I have spent some time with Lai, and I know you both have, Jude and Richard. And what you hear among experts in Washington and the region is generally that he's going to continue Tsai Ing-wen's policies. But you do hear some analysts and experts concerned that he may be a little more like Chen Shui-bian, a little more animated by de jure, or if not de jure, de facto independence, and may not be as disciplined as Tsai was. I tend to think from my brief encounters with him that he's more likely to continue the Tsai line. But Richard, what's your take on him? Is he nine parts Tsai and one part Chen Shui-bian, or how would you sort of judge what we should expect?
I'm more in line with you, and let me explain why. First of all, I'd make the general point that we should not prejudge what he's going to do. There's a party to this dispute that does prejudge him, that has already written him off, and that, I think, is unfortunate. He is facing enormous challenges with respect to policy, not only external policy towards China, but a lot of difficult problems at home having to do with an aging society and an advanced industrial economy. I take him at his word when he says that he is going to pursue a policy of continuity with Tsai. He has repeated, for example, Tsai's mantra when it comes to dealing with China and the United States, and that is, we will not bow to pressure from China, but we will not provoke China simply because we have the support of the United States. That's a really good policy line. It provides an answer to a lot of various proposals that come up on what to do. There will be pressures on him from people within his own party who want him to push the envelope and move from the de jure, from the de facto independence that they already have to de jure or legal independence, a Republic of Taiwan. But I think, you know, number one, he understands that the great majority of the public prefers the status quo. They don't want reckless moves in either in the direction of independence or in the direction of unification. They're very risk averse. Second, he understands from polling, I think, that the public believes that if Taiwan were to declare independence, there would be a war. China would attack. And in that circumstance, U.S. support is not at all certain. The DPP, Lai's party, has evolved over the last 20 years since Chen Shui-bian was in office and accommodated itself to the status quo preferences of the population. Finally, I would note that the surprise of this election, that it was not all about China, which you'd expect, but for a significant part of the population, it was domestic quality of life issues, income, wealth, housing inequality, lack of fulfilling jobs. If you're in the IT sector, you're fine. But if you're outside the IT sector, life isn't so good. They feel that both the DPP and the KMT have neglected those. And that's why Mr. Ko Wen-je, who was the third party candidate, got the kind of support that he did. So if Mr. Lai wants to have a second term, he's going to have to focus on those issues because that's what's on people's mind. I can't guarantee that he won't go in a risky direction, but he has a lot of reasons not to.
Richard, I want to ask you for your assessment of how Beijing is processing the election. And I wonder if I can do this by sort of laying out two narratives that may be echoing through the halls of Zhongnanhai and ask you which one you think is more likely to be how Beijing is processing events. One way you could see Beijing interpreting the election is DPP has now won three consecutive elections. If we look at this in conjunction with polling data in Taiwan, where we're seeing, again, a consolidation of Taiwan identity plus actions from the United States starting in the Trump administration and into Biden, what Beijing frames as sort of salami slicing, we're really running out of runway here, right? We're losing Taiwan. This election really might cause us to accelerate our anxiety or even sort of potential timelines. So let's say that's broadly narrative number one. The second narrative is actually, we look at this election result, it could have been a lot worse for us. Lai wins only 40% of the vote. So as Beijing has been saying, 60% voted against the DPP. If you look in the legislative yuan, the DPP has lost its majority. So this is going to be a real slog for a Lai administration. You're seeing growing skepticism on Taiwan about the United States, et cetera, et cetera. So actually, we might be well positioned to think about potential progress on our terms over the next 4 years leading into 2028. I've dramatically simplified and I realize there's shades in between, but if you had to guess how Beijing was processing events, which broad narrative do you think is closer to Beijing's view?
On the one hand, the elements of the first narrative are in Beijing's rhetoric about Taiwan. We're heading towards the end of civilization as we know it because of those independence people on Taiwan. I think the reality is closer to your second narrative. I had a lunch with some PRC diplomats not too many days after the election. They were quite relaxed for some of the reasons that you laid out. I think that Beijing is happy to see political power fragmented in Taiwan in the way that it was in this election. It is probably comforted by the fact that there are a lot of domestic issues that Lai will have to deal with. The other thing is that based on their strategy of what I call coercion without violence and what you, Jude, have written about very effectively, you don't need to have success 2 years from now or 4 years from now. This is an incremental process of undermining the confidence of the Taiwan people. It already appears that to some extent it's working. This election could be read as a sign that uncertainty in Taiwan and lack of confidence in the future is growing, and that works to Beijing's advantage. What Beijing would do if President Lai did something very provocative, I think they would feel they had to act in some way. If we did something that was really provocative, they would have to react. If Lai did something very provocative, Beijing would probably come to us and try to get us to sort of rein him in. I think that the various factors involved suggest that we should not be too alarmist about this and not prejudge what the future is going to bring.
I guess building on that, how then would you describe what you think Beijing's strategy is going to be over the next, let's say, certainly over the next 4 years, but if we think of this a little bit longer term, where are going to be the key pressure points? And how do you think Beijing will be assessing progress towards its ultimate goal? The reason I'm asking this is, of course, I think that most of the discussion here in Washington feels like it's oriented around thinking about invasion scenarios. And again, that's why I asked, if Beijing thinks it's running out of time, then suddenly, yeah, some of these scenarios around outer island seizures or something even more dramatic seems possible. If it's closer to door B or door number two, which is actually they see some developments occurring that seem to show that there are some tailwinds in their favor, then that's a different strategy. But what is that strategy, do you think, functionally? Is it just is it continuation of what they've been doing of strangulation, using things like the death of two fishermen, Chinese fishermen, as a way to start getting the Chinese Coast Guard even closer to Kinmen? Is it just that sort of gradual but relentless salami slicing coercion, or do you think they might potentially be formulating a more bolder approach?
A couple of points by way of context. First of all, Beijing's hope was always that they would be able to persuade Taiwan's leaders and then also the Taiwan public to accept incorporation into the People's Republic of China on China's terms, the formula called One Country, Two Systems. It really wanted to settle this peacefully. It still says it wants a peaceful reunification. An important reason for that is they want access to the Taiwan economy and to the centers of excellence in the Taiwan economy. And if you destroy the place, that is no longer an opportunity. They had the best chance for persuasion to work when Ma Ying-jeou was president from 2008 to 2016, because he was the head of the Kuomintang, the more conservative party, the one that believed in engagement with China as a way to preserve Taiwan's autonomy. That didn't work out, and the DPP came back to power. I think they understand all the risks and downsides of going to war. They couldn't even be sure of winning. So I think that coercion is a good Goldilocks solution to their policy problem. And you know, they might have some confidence that in 2028, there will emerge a conservative party in power that would be willing to deal with the mainland on terms, at least in a way that might lead to a productive outcome. I also think that they have decided that Taiwan's center of gravity right now is the confidence of the political leadership and the confidence of the public. And it is possible to wear that down and to undermine the sense that everything is going to be okay. That is the way they treat their own people whom they don't like, right? They've used similar tactics in other places in East Asia. From my point of view, this isn't a purely military conflict. It's a political dispute with a military dimension. But there are lots of other things that they can do besides displays of force. Economic sanctions, taking away Taiwan's diplomatic allies, using information warfare, propaganda, cyber, and so on. And provide every day new evidence to people in Taiwan that China's powerful and Taiwan's not. Taiwan people should understand that which way the trends are going. Interestingly, some of the planning that is being done in Beijing concerning economic relations and in terms of national identity is pretty long-term in its focus, the stuff that Wang Huning is working on. If somebody at that level has that kind of time frame, it suggests a willingness to be patient, a confidence that it's going to work. It could be clean and done on a mutually acceptable basis. It could be messy, but in the end, they will win. And as far as assessing progress, if Xi Jinping says they're making progress, they're making progress.
It's the good thing about being the autocrat is you can define and redefine the measuring stick.
So Richard, you've had a front row seat, you've had a driver's seat for U.S. Policy on Taiwan for decades. Yeah, I'm looking at things like Gallup polls where 15% of Americans have a positive view of the PRC and 77% have a positive view of Taiwan. President Biden has sandblasted strategic ambiguity four times now and basically said if he's president, he'd defend Taiwan if it's attacked. Half of Americans in polls now say that we, the U.S., should defend Taiwan if it's attacked. That's lower than the numbers for Japan or Korea, which you know tend to be 65%, but it's historically high for Taiwan. In Australia, my center asked that question, and a similar number, slightly over half of Australians consistently say, look, if the U.S. is going to have to defend Taiwan, Australia's in. And Japan, I mean, the whole Japan defense integration with the U.S. is at one level about Taiwan, and the Japanese side knows there's no sitting out. So if I were in Taiwan, I'd think, wow, there's never been so much support for Taiwan politically, militarily, and yet in polls in Taiwan, there seems to be in a lot of surveys and in a lot of social media growing skepticism that the U.S. would actually defend Taiwan. Part of the reason a group of us were sent there shortly after the Ukraine war was because the State Department was seeing those numbers and wanted non-government officials to say how much support there is for Taiwan. So what's happening? Are the Taiwanese skeptics right that actually there isn't that much support in the U.S. and Australia and Japan and the West? Or are they missing something? Or is Chinese disinformation effective? What's happening? How do you have these two completely different views of external support for Taiwan in a contingency?
Well, first of all, I would want to know who was doing this polling. Polling in Taiwan is a creative art. Pollsters are very skillful at getting the answer that they want by crafting the question in a certain way. There are some organizations that are methodologically more sound and have more integrity, and I put a lot more confidence in those than, you know, a poll that is less scrupulous. Second, I would say that, as you know, Mike, from the various perches you've been on, if you were a junior partner of the United States, whether you're Japan or South Korea or Taiwan, you are constantly anxious about the credibility of the U.S. commitment. You're always looking for signs that the Americans are going to renege and not come to your defense when you need it.
I've been a professional psychotherapist for four decades because of that phenomenon.
I hope you're getting paid for it.
Not as much as a psychotherapist, but enough.
And Taiwan's no different. I mean, we have sold out Taiwan a number of times. So there's a historical record that they can point to that might strengthen this view. Third, I would say that there are some people on the right in Taiwan who see an interest in fanning the flames of doubt because it works to their political advantage. We probably both know some of these people. I think it is probably quite worrisome to observers in Taiwan right now that the Congress has not been able to appropriate funds to support Ukraine. If we can't provide support in that situation, what could Taiwan expect if it were attacked? So I think it is important for us to explain as clearly as we can our definition of the situation, that we see the threat in ways that are quite similar to Taiwan's. We understand the damage that would be done to international society if Taiwan were bullied or beaten into accepting a bad deal with a dictatorial China. Japan, I think, would be unhappy with that result as well, for obvious reasons. So I think that there is a lot of public diplomacy that can be done to strengthen sentiment in Taiwan. Our unofficial relationship is a bit of an obstacle to that, but there are ways to get around that. It happens that our officials in Taiwan and our operations around Taiwan are much more public than they were before 2016. As you know, before then, we would regularly send destroyers through the Taiwan Strait, but we wouldn't make it public. We were confident that the PLA knew that we were doing it. And so if the PLA is the target of your deterrence effort, maybe it has an impact. As I suggested, China's center of gravity when it comes to Taiwan is the Taiwan public. If it's important that Taiwan sustain its confidence, then we have a responsibility to help bolster that confidence any way we can. So now when we send destroyers through the strait, we announce it. And we're doing it not for the benefit of the PLA, but for the benefit of people in Taiwan. Our director is in the media just about every day, just reminding people that the United States is there. The fact that other countries in Asia and countries in Europe are associating themselves with the American point of view in support of Taiwan, it helps. But China is there and China's behaving badly. Taiwan does have problems, and we need to continue to send those messages that we have their back. We appreciate what Taiwan is and the way it has acted in a restrained way in recent years.
So I'm going to try to get a few more minutes of your wisdom on this before I turn it back over to Jude to wrap up the discussion. So maybe a quick kind of multiple choice. So J.D. Vance, the senator from Ohio at the Munich Security Conference, others in the kind of MAGA world have argued that we need to stop supporting Ukraine and some would say NATO so we can focus like a laser on the China threat in Asia and the Taiwan problem. And what I'm hearing from you, which I strongly agree with, is that's somewhere between ludicrous and unfortunate, because what you're saying is Taiwan, and we know this is true for Japan and others, are watching actually Ukraine and how the Congress acts on Ukraine like a laser. So it's. I just want to get you on the record. That's not a strong strategic argument, is it, that we need to get out of Ukraine to focus on Taiwan? It's actually the opposite effect, it sounds like.
It's a very foolish argument.
Foolish. That's the word I was looking for. Not ludicrous, not unfortunate, foolish. And then on the level of U.S. and international support for Taiwan, it sounds like you agree there is more within the Congress for Taiwan, the Ukraine thing, setting that aside, than there has been in a long time? Or do you think it's a bit more superficial than that?
There's a lot of attention to Taiwan. There is a lot more activity in the Congress. Some of it is superficial, but some of it is consequential. The United States is going to be providing taxpayer money to Taiwan to help it buy U.S. weapons. If somebody had proposed that to me when I was AIT chairman, I would say, oh, we can never do that. That would cross the boundary of what is official and unofficial, and China will be very mad. Well, we may be getting away with this, and so that's important. I do think there is an unfortunate tendency in Congress, in the media, in some academic circles to treat this as simply a military conflict, and therefore there's only a military solution. Now, we do have to worry about the threat that China's growing military capabilities pose to Taiwan, but also to Japan and Korea and the United States' position in the Western Pacific. But at the same time, we have to worry about the approach that China is using now to deal with its Taiwan problem, and that is coercion. We have a big five-sided building that deals with the military challenges. We don't have an agency of government to do counter-coercion. And so you have to knit together interagency cooperation. You need to create relationships with Taiwan that allow us to help Taiwan in the best possible way. I'm pleased that support is stronger. I also hope that people understand not only that we should be helping Taiwan, but why and how. So that's a job for Jude.
Richard, final question, which is your assessment of the state of the field, so to speak. It's both so enriching to listen to you. It's also slightly depressing because you're retired. And so I know that you're not going to be as active as you once were. And I look around and see Shelley Rigger, Bonnie Glaser, you know, we still have these amazing voices who just have such a deep understanding of Taiwan. But as you were just saying, there's a lot of focus on Taiwan. There's not many Richard Bushes out there. And so I'm curious on your view of how well positioned we are. Lots of folks looking at the military dimension, lots of folks who are looking at counter-invasion scenarios, but how many folks really understand with a tactile sense domestic politics in Taiwan? So how well positioned are we, or put another way, how bad is it? And what do you think we should do holistically to try to get more well-trained voices into the policy discussion?
First of all, we should acknowledge that there is a lot of talent within the U.S. government when it comes to understanding Taiwan. AIT, Department of State, various agencies of the U.S. government, the intelligence community. That is very important for policymakers. It doesn't help with the larger job of public education. I have something of the same concern as you do. In each age cohort, you do find a few good people who have chosen to focus on Taiwan and its political system, and that's good. I think that there is also a tendency, which is true in academia generally, is to sort of branch off into non-politics areas of inquiry. Those can be very interesting, but they have nothing to do really with politics. I do wish there were more people. I wish that we could clone people like Bonnie and Karis Templeman and multiply our talents. We do have very good contacts with scholars in Taiwan who themselves try their hardest to understand their own political system. So that's an asset as well. So I'm not despairing. These are tough issues. The stakes are really high, so we can't afford to get it wrong just because we don't have enough people.
Yeah, for sure. Though I'm still, the idea of cloning Karis is still, I'm seeing an army of Karis Templemans descending on DC, but point taken. Richard, really want to thank you for this. And again, I know you're golfing and puttering in the yard and all the things that active retirees get to do. So really appreciate you popping your head up and being willing to talk to Mike and I, especially close to 8 o'clock at night for us here on the East Coast. So a pleasure as always. Learn so much from you. And I always tell people that anytime I say anything on Taiwan, it's really just a sort of distorted echo of what I once heard Richard Bush say. So appreciate for all you've taught me. So thank you, Richard. Appreciate it. Hope to see you soon in person.
Thank you very much. It was a great pleasure. You asked great questions, and I thought it was a good conversation.
And I think Jude just talked you out of retiring, so that was a good outcome.
For more on strategy and the Asia program's work, visit the CSIS website at csis.org and click on the Asia program page. And for more on the U.S. Studies Center in Sydney, please visit ussc.edu.au.